Please don't let that ever happen. I have too much love within me for you. Is he looking after you? Is he showing you the same love, a warm love, just like we knew? Baby, baby, it's you I'm thinking of. In the morning when I wake up, in the evening, it's you that I dream of. Sometimes love hurts, and sometimes love's unkind, and sometimes you might feel blue. But remember now, darling, if his words are real, this will never, never happen to you. Baby, baby, there's things I'd like to say. I was hoping that with our love, we would get married someday.
And joining us right now is Ray Graffia Jr. You know him, of course. You know him, love him, and from New Colony 6. And I grew up with their music. I love some of their music. In fact, you go down and you discover some of the stuff you haven't heard for a while. Of course, we all know things like I Will Always Think About You and Things I'd Like to Say, which both were around the top 20 in the country. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other songs that did well. And Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate the invitation to participate. And you're right about the subliminal recollection that occurs when people hear the music. When I talk to people nowadays that are not or are of our age group, it's not necessarily a circumstance where if you say New Colony 6, they go, oh, yeah. And even if you say, I Will Always Think About You and Things I'd Like to Say, they may not go, oh, yeah. But if you play the songs,
yep.
You did that one? You did that one? You did that one? Yeah, it's kind of it's a unique circumstance where I don't know that the titles or the band name was memorable, but I think the music was.
Well, it is interesting you mention that because I did mention it to a number of people. I was at a gym the other day. There was about 40 or 50 people there. And they said, well, you have this this week? And I said, well, you know, Wednesday I have Ray Graffia from New Colony 6. They're like, okay. I said, they're the guys who did Things I Like to Say. Okay. I said, remember that? Baby, baby, yeah. It's you. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Absolutely so, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
And one of the great things about the CD revolution and some of the companies out there like Sundaes and Rhino,
mm-hmm.
Sundaes has released pretty much all of them. I mean, from Breakthrough. Did they release all the CDs you guys had out?
At this point, everything that we ever did that was put out has been released on CD. Yeah, I want to say that's accurate. And in fact, with Sundaes having now gone back just recently and redoing Breakthrough and having done Colonization, which was the second album.
Right, and then Revelations.
And Revelations and Attacking a Straw Man,
right.
Both of which were Mercury.
Right.
They were released by Mercury of Japan a couple of years ago. Now, I don't know that you can get it here locally, but...
on the Internet you can.
Pardon me?
On the Internet, it's all available.
Ah, okay. So even the one from Japan.
And then, of course, Rhino has a great album called Colonization, the
right.
Rest of the New Colony 6.
Right, and that's got all of the hits. But some people like the earlier material, some people just like the hits, but it's interesting. There's just about anything you could ask for on the Colony is out there nowadays.
Well, we're going to talk to you about Colony. I want to know all about it, and I want to know all about you. So you guys were raised around, what, Chicago, right?
Yes, every one of us, the original band... which first performed one party as the Patsmen, was named that because we all went to St. Patrick High School, a bunch of good young Catholic boys.
So six of you ended up on stage at the high school.
Right.
And it was a huge smash.
Yeah, it was kind of unexpected. We were, it was, of course, right at the time, I graduated high school in 1964. And that was, of course, the time of the British invasion and the Beatles hit big and so on. So we decided in the final concert of the year, senior year, that we would do a Beatle imitation. And originally they were talking about lip syncing, and we convinced them that we should do it live. So we did I Want to Hold Your Hand. And the neighboring girls' school with whom we did the concert invited us to come and replicate what we had done at their first sock hop, which of course dates me, the following fall. And over that summer, we said, well, heck, if we're going to do one song, why don't we learn a few? And pretty soon we did a party as the Patsmen, and we thought that was really a lame name. And so in light of the British invasion, we decided, well, what does Britain call America, the new colonies? So since there were six of us, hence New Colony Six.
There you go. There's the quick history. Now, the original six members were?
Myself, Jerry Van Collenberg, Jim Chakowski, Pat McBride, Craig Kemp, and Wally Kemp.
Hmm. Now, Craig Kemp, their actual name was
Gregory
Kempinski, right?
If you want to be formal.
Right. So, and then, of course, Chick James was actually James Chakowski.
Correct.
So there was a little thing of that. But so then you guys started as the New Colony Six. Now, everybody said, oh, great, then automatically it was a big-time stuff. But, you know, you got to start small. You guys amassed a good following locally, right?
Yes, we did. We did a lot of college dates, a lot of high school dates. At that time, there was a phenomenon. I know it was phenomenal in Chicago. I don't know whether it was going on countrywide, but it was called teenage nightclubs, where they didn't serve alcohol, but it was a place where younger kids could come and listen to music, because that's what it featured, live performances. And they had like juice bars and sodas and stuff like that, and they called them teenage nightclubs. So we did a lot of that. And of course, the real honing of your chops, if you will, was in the 4 a.m. bars, where everybody went home but the owner, but by gosh, he was paying you $125 to play all night. You darn well were going to play all night. So we got a good opportunity to spend a lot of early mornings honing our skills in an empty facility with just a bartender and the owner and us playing for him.
So then you guys said, well, you know, we're doing so well in Chicago, it's time to go to Hollywood.
Absolutely. You couldn't, we felt, make it out of Chicago at the time, because up until the blues musicians for a little bit had some success coming out of Chicago, it seemed like there was no chance of actually cutting a record here. So, yeah, we went off to the West Coast.
You moved into a place in Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, that's
and
a,
upstairs from you
that's a
was
weird
a little-known group, Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Yeah, it was, we didn't know them, of course, at that time, and they didn't know us, of course. They may not know us today, but in any case, but if they heard the music, they'll remember it. Anyway,
yeah, you could just sing to them.
Yes. Yeah. We actually wound up sharing living space with them, and we didn't realize that there was a connection as tight as it turns out to be, especially if you look at the early costumes that we wore.
Yeah, they were both colonial, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We were coming back from, I forget exactly where it was, some local park, like a amusement park, and we had done a performance, and they didn't have a very big space for changing, so we just wore the outfits back. And as we were pulling up, they were going out, and they decided to dress for wherever it was that they're going, and all of a sudden they see us and we see them, and we're virtually dressed identically, except they're carrying these three-cornered hats, which of course we didn't wear.
Right.
So we just figured, well, it's not that big a deal. And then we came back to Chicago, and of course they hit on where the action is. That was the time that the colony decided we better change the look, because otherwise people are going to think we're Raiders ripoffs.
Now, I guess the big difference between you and the Raiders at that time was a little-known fellow named Dick Clark.
Oh, yeah.
How did they connect with him? Or maybe you don't know about that.
I don't know that.
Yeah,
I wish we had had that opportunity, because we didn't even get a chance. No audition. I guess we just weren't aware of the fact that they were going to be starting this Where the Action Is thing to follow up after Bandstand. And, of course, Bandstand went on. But when they won the audition to become the house band, quote-unquote, for Where the Action Is, obviously that really, really made an impact.
But at the time, were you folks still living downstairs from them?
Yes.
So why didn't you say to him, hey, guys, can you get us a gig on the show? Try it, you know.
We didn't know at that point that there was going to be such an uproar over this. And, of course, you know, Dick Clark was not as famous then, although he was famous, as he was now, as he is now. And I guess a bunch of naive kids were too stupid to ask.
Well, you must have been cursing Paul Revere and the Raiders all day.
No, to be honest with you, God bless him for the success. The concept of bringing rock and roll back to America, it was just two great ideas formed in different parts of the country, just happened to be coincidental.
So you guys moved back to Chicago.
Yep.
Worked hard all night again doing what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I understand, I think this is kind of the cool part that I really like, and that is the fact that your parents all said, you know, you guys are really dedicated to this. Let us put some money in together, start a record company, and help you guys out. And
exactly,
your dad was
right.
Actually the guy who served as president of the company, right?
Yep. We came back having written a lot of material. When we went out there to California, we had a couple of tunes that we had written. But since we didn't have a whole lot of opportunities to perform and a lot of time to spend, we started writing a lot of material. So when we came back, we started playing some of the material to the parents, because every once in a while they'd come over and see how the band was doing. And, of course, once we came back from California, that was something that they definitely wanted to spend a lot of time with us. And all of a sudden my dad says, God, this stuff is great. I can't believe you guys don't have a record contract. And we said, well, yeah, we had an audition for Capitol, but they didn't like the material, and so that was that. And he says, well, you know what? We're going to start a record company. And it almost sounds like a Spanky and Our Gang type of an episode, but that's the reality of it. He went to each of the parents and said, are you in or are you not? And gave everybody an opportunity to throw a few bucks into the pot, and lo and behold, Centaur Records.
And then the Centaur Records' first release was the garage classic Guy Confess.
Correct.
That was November of 1965.
Yeah, I can remember I had a Triumph TR3 at that time, a red convertible with side curtains, didn't even have the roll-up windows back in that. It was 59.
Yeah, it's amazing, because that song actually did really well on your local station, WLS, which, like WBZ here in Boston, mm-hmm. was a nighttime show that, a nighttime signal that would hit like 38 states.
Yeah, it was interesting, because they used to have a request line, and they actually played the song, and I was going berserk on the Kennedy Expressway as we're driving down, saying, that's me, that's me. And it really went over very well, whether it was all of our cousins, aunts, uncles, and friends, or the universal appeal of the music. I can't answer that, but the bottom line is they got enough requests to continue to play it that pretty soon it went into rotation, and boom, by February, I think it was, of 66, it hit number two.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, the WLS thing that you're talking about was called the Silver Dollar Survey.
Exactly.
And the back of that song, the back of the single called Dawn is Breaking, also was kind of a cool song, too, that that did pretty well, too. People like that.
Yes, it's the early days of the band, we were pretty adventuresome. We were probably just not smart enough musically to know that you couldn't try this and you couldn't do that. So we did a lot of things that might have been a little bit unique, perhaps from that naivete as musicians.
And that, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, I confess was a great garage classic rock. Dawn is Breaking was kind of an eerie organ type music.
Yeah,
it was a little different.
People had said, a couple of write-ups I'd seen along the years compared it to some of the early Them material back when Van Morrison was still fronting the group.
Mm. And then, of course, after that was I Lie Awake.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of like a Yardbird song.
Yeah, now that though, I don't know if the people who are listening are classical music interested at all, but if they are, perhaps they can note that the connection there was George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Hmm. We listened to a lot of music besides the typical rock and roll, and became enamored with that. Which essentially then became I Lie Awake. So if you listen to that very carefully and you're familiar with Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, you'll see the connection.
That's cool, but that song unfortunately had some problems because of the name Centaur, which ended up being changed to Centaur Records.
Yeah. There was some
lawyers.
Yeah, it's Warren Zevon was right. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Yeah, but in the summer of '66, You guys had a change in personnel. Craig Kemp left, and I think this might have been a key to the success of the group when Ronnie Rice joined.
Yeah, big shift in emphasis. Ronnie was had a beautiful voice, which is obvious on I Will Always Think About You and Things I'd Like to Say, and we tried to utilize that along with the writing skills that he demonstrated for ballads. So when he and Les Kummel, a.k.a. Les Stewart, began to write some material together, they produced material that obviously was very, very widely accepted, tons of airplay, and sold gajillions of records.
And that was a key, too, when Wal Kemp left in 67 in the summer, and then Les Kummel came in.
Mm-hmm.
Because, they, again, you're right about the combination songwriting was it was incredible, actually.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about that, about Rice for a second, because he's, I thought that was really interesting that he's actually an Israeli. He was born in Israel, right?
Yeah, correct.
Joining a group of Irishmen.
Yeah. Well, just because we went to St. Pat's. I don't know, other than Pat McBride, I'm not sure anybody else was Irish.
Oh, really?
I didn't. Wally and Greg were Polish. Jerry and I were German and Italian, and Chick, of course, with a Tchaikovsky. How could you not know what that is?
Mm. So that was interesting. I mean, but Ronnie has an incredible voice, and,
yes.
And he had done some solo stuff on his own that didn't really do much, right?
Exactly. Pat and I were attending Columbia College, which is a liberal arts university that after the band hit, I started out thinking I was going to be an engineer, and then I said, I don't need to work that hard, so I'll go into something simpler, and went into liberal arts areas, and we were both going to Columbia, and a fellow student there was Ronnie Rice, and so when we were contemplating what to do, and we knew Ronnie from some of the single material that he had released as an artist, we had the impression that he was a very good keyboard player. And while he was a wonderful voice and a reasonably decent rhythm guitar player, he looks like a one-fingered typewriter person rather than a keyboard player by the time we hired him, but we brought him in actually to play keyboards.
Huh, that's interesting. The next big song you guys had was probably Love You So Much, which
yeah.
I really liked. That had that rapid fire rhythm and a real power pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flip side was really a hard rock song.
Yeah, Let Me Love You.
I love that one. That was great.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
It comes into and becomes like a ballad.
Yeah, it's musically we probably didn't know that you're not supposed to do this or that, and so we just tried it. And if we thought it sounded neat, we would go ahead and do it.
He had a couple of, that song actually made number 55 in Cashbox.
Mm-hmm.
And the next following song, You're Gonna Be Mine, also was number 8, number
mm-hmm.
98. That one had some really nice harmony in it. And that was later became one of the trademarks.
Yeah, I was going to say, trademark is a good word. That I think probably the intricacies of our vocals was one of the things that made the band stand out both in a live performance and in studio work. That and the antics. We were, I think, reasonably funny at the time. I'm not so sure that that's the case anymore, but back in those days we had a good group sense of humor, so we did a lot of stupid stuff that was well received by the congregation that was there to hear us play, and it was something that I think, again, that they made us stand apart from a lot of the other Chicago bands that popped to the charts after we hit first.
You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at a picture of you from this Greatest Hits package that Rhino put out,
mm-hmm.
and you have a Nehru jacket on.
Here's
striped,
the funny thing, Mark. Number
bell buttons.
One, I've still got the jacket, and
really?
Number two, it still fits.
Wow.
A little short in the arms, but it still fits.
I think you should save that for the Music Hall of Fame.
If we ever got in, that would be a wonderful gift that I would be glad to do in return for getting there.
I think you should go to Cleveland and go to the Hall of Fame and say, we think the New Colony 6 should be in there. And they'll say, who's the New Colony 6? And you'll say, Things I Like to Say. And they'll say, huh? And you'll say, baby, oh, yeah, come on
exactly,
in.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, that's a horse of a different color. But so, and one of the things I thought was interesting too, in the summer of '67, when you added Les Kummel and Walter Kemp left, you guys released a song called "I'm Just Waiting, Anticipating for Her to Show Up," which didn't really crack the Billboard too much. It went to like 128 or something. But one of the things I thought was really interesting on that is that you guys did the vocals, but the music was done by somebody else.
Yeah, we had we were doing a lot of touring at that time, and management wanted to get another single out. And they had found this tune, which there's another anecdote. I don't know if you're going to get to it, but did you notice who wrote it? T. Orlando, you know who that is?
Tony Orlando, yeah.
Yeah, so Tony Orlando actually wrote it. I think he was 16 when he wrote it with his uncle, sent it around, and so on. But in any case, while we were chasing around, they thought that it would be a good idea to go ahead and get this track down, and then we'll just come in and do the vocals. So that's, yeah, that's the only time we ever did that. And I almost wish we hadn't, but what can I say? Sometimes management, and again, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, and people that are of an adult age and with far more wisdom in the record industry say, why don't we do this? You go, well, okay.
I think the interesting thing after the summer of 67 is that you guys went over to Chicago, where you lived, and talked to Mercury Records. Tell me about that. I know you guys gave them a demo with two songs, and I assume you remembered that whole story. I think it's pretty funny.
Why don't you go ahead and tell me what your recollection is of it, because I've heard several versions of this, and personally, I was not involved.
Oh, okay, because I understand that, that Ronnie Rice actually went down there with a demo of two songs. One was Treater Groovy. The other one was I Will Always Think About You.
That's right, and I Will Always Think About You was not real excitedly received.
Yeah, they didn't like that song. They liked Treater Groovy. They said, that's going to be a hit. The other one's, you know, we can do without. And I think that's hilarious because, of course, then they put Treater Groovy out, and with the muscle of Mercury, which was big at the time.
Absolutely.
And it didn't even chart nationally at all.
Correct.
But then they release I Will Always Think About You, and it becomes number one on WLS, and it becomes a big hit, number 22, which got you guys national attention. And finally, there you were nationally doing all the things national bands do.
Thank goodness.
Because I know that you guys did the Mike Douglas show and Upbeat and all the Showcase 68, all of these. What was it like at that time? Tell me what it's like to finally, after all these years of doing these things and hitting the bubble. You guys were on the bubble. Finally penetrating that bubble and hitting the top 20.
It's, other than the fact that the venues got larger and the crowds got larger and the remunerations, which of course we didn't see because at our age they just kind of gave us a salary kind of a deal, there wasn't a whole major difference. It's, I don't want to sound arrogant, but in all honesty, I really expected that we would just keep putting them out there and eventually this was going to happen. I really expected that that would be the case. And when it did, other than those relatively insignificant changes, because if you're up on stage and there's 500 people or 5,000 people, certainly you can note the difference, but if the venue size is correlated to the size of the crowd, it's not that significant a change. So from my perspective, it was something that just was a natural progression. Things went better, and so crowds got larger and venues got larger.
But I would assume that your parents and your friends and all the people you knew, you know, you, all of a sudden your pictures didn't go into Montgomery Ward's catalog with 21 million people. You're touring with the Beach Boys. You're raising 30,000 Toys for Tots in Louisville. I mean, you know, life
did
change.
True. I shouldn't minimize it that much. I can remember a couple of times, one specifically in the local shopping center to where I live, and was actually being followed by a young girl, and I didn't notice it at first, but then I began to be troubled by it. So I actually stopped and turned around and went up and I said, "Can I help you?" And she said, "Aren't you Ray from the New Colony 6?" I thought, "Oh my goodness gracious, I can't believe this has happened." But yeah, that those kinds of things, not tremendously frequently, but just, I mean, that one circumstance particularly, I'll never forget.
So you guys were voted the best Chicago area group by WLS in 68 and 69.
Yeah, the only 2 years I think that they ever ran the promotion, and we won it. So that, God bless the Chicago listeners.
You know what I think it's kind of a funny thing, though, when you think about all this thing, because, you know, I Will Always Love You was a huge, I always think about it, was a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody loved it. It was a very, very tender ballad. And I think that once that became a big hit, it might have been tougher for you guys to chart with some of the psychedelic and up-tempo and rock cuts you were used to doing.
Without question. And that's when the band really started to transition on record. Live performances pretty much didn't change. We still used, one of the things I think that was unique to us when we came back from California is the West Coast influences, the psychedelic lights and the projectors with the oil things and water that you would put different colors in and all that kind of stuff. We used a lot of that, strobe lights and so on. So the live act didn't change, but it almost got to a point where we become so middle of the road that the things we did on stage seemed out of character for what the records were coming out, all ballad after ballad after ballad.
Hmm. And, you know, in October 68, your biggest success came. And from what I understand, if it wasn't for Larry Lujack, it might not have happened.
Absolutely true. When we, again, trying to stay out of the mold of stereotype and trying to promote the B-side of Things I'd Like to Say, a song called Come and Give Your Love to Me, we had convinced Merck that that's what that should be pushed. So that was what they originally released as the A side of that record.
Hmm.
And we did a performance with Larry Lujack, and he came on. We used to travel in a bus. We had a double-decker Scenic Cruiser Greyhound bus that we had redone the inside of. And Larry came and sat down after a performance where he was the MC and we were the quote-unquote star of the show. And afterwards he said, "You guys are playing the wrong side of this record." And so obviously Larry Lujack being the pretty much rock idol of DJs, at least in the Midwest, if not all over the country, from the, like you said, the strong signal that LS had, you listened to that. So we went back to management and said, "Well, Larry Lujack thinks we're playing the wrong side of the record." Well, next thing that happens is suddenly they're playing Things I'd Like to Say, and boom, you're right. Mm. Major, major hit.
Oh, yeah, that was big. That hit number 13 in Cashbox.
Mm-hmm.
And was a major hit that I went and bought. I bought the single. I have it still.
Thank you.
It's all scratched up, but it's still around. The only problem with records is they can't play on the air anymore.
This is true.
1969, right after that, was a huge year in terms of personnel changes. Billy Herman came in to replace Chick James,
right.
Chuck Jobes, and Bruce Jordan came in to replace, I guess they just joined the group.
Mm-hmm.
But they had actually been in the Revels with... Revels, yeah, with Les Kummel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of joined in. And then in August of 1969... you left.
Da, da, da.
Why did you leave the New Colony 6?
Be honest with you, Mark.
Yeah.
I had graduated college with the changes in personnel and some turmoil that was involved with the band as a unit wanting to leave what was perceived again as a group to be a restriction, i.e. Centaur. I wound up in a situation where there was a potential that I was going to wind up in a lawsuit against my dad.
Mm.
And that was not a very comforting thought. I have a long-term, still have a relationship with my parents, who, God bless them, are still alive at 83 years old each.
That's great.
And that, coupled with the fact that I was thinking to myself, I'm not sure how much longer this is going to be able to go on. And I've got this degree, why don't I do something with it? So you put all those things together, and I said, you know what, I'm going.
Mm. Now, you also, you know, formed a new band with Chick James and Craig Kemp.
Right, right. You know, I guess as easy as it was to say I'm going to leave, that's how hard it was to say I'm going to quit performing completely.
Right.
So within a matter of weeks, Chick was still kind of antsy to play, and Craig was kind of antsy to get back into it, and so the three of us, along with two other players that we had met, formed the band that we called the RJM Group, or sometimes also known as Raymond John Michael.
And then, of course, in 70, Les Kummel left, but Pat McBride still, as New Colony 6, released a number of records, they didn't. Some of them did okay. I mean, Rock Roll On did all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pat and Jerry and Ronnie stayed for a while, and I think Ronnie then finally left. I think Jerry was the last one to carry on the tradition until we resurrected in 1988, where Ronnie had done some performances and was looking. He was performing as a solo act, still does in the Chicago area, and he wanted to do something different for a concert venue. And 2 years in a row, he asked me if I'd come back, and I said, no, I'm a pollution prevention sales guy anymore. I'd feel very uncomfortable. And then by 1988, I finally said, okay, I'll do one performance. Well, that went over so well. I remembered how much fun it was, and the reaction of the crowd was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. That we've now been performing since 1988 as a reunion band.
So you still do it with Ronnie?
Actually, Ronnie is with us from time to time, but because that's his sole means of support, mm-hmm. and the band sounds so good when you have all of those players as opposed to Ronnie by himself and acoustic guitar, that he doesn't want to jeopardize his long-term. This is my perspective. You can ask him about it directly, but my perspective is, if I were he, I wouldn't want to jeopardize my livelihood by a periodic performance with the band other than just sort of a guest star kind of a thing.
Mm. Interesting stuff. I mean, you know, this is people love nostalgia. They love the songs, and,
mm-hmm.
and I would assume when you're playing now that they're just as enthusiastic as they were 35 years ago.
It is amazing. There's a lot more gray and a lot less hair, but yeah, the crowds are still very responsive, and the fun part now is that obviously you have to do the Colony material. But now you can also segue into things that you wouldn't have thought of doing because it would be endorsing the enemy, quote-unquote, back in those days, which is to do some of the hits of the Paul Revere's and the Raiders and the Monkees and all of the other people, the British invasion groups, that were our competition back in those days.
Mm.
And the fun thing that we've started to do a couple years ago, I have a 15-and-a-half-year-old son along with an 18- and a 21-year-old daughter, and my son said, you know, the band is good, but you guys really do lame material. You got to do something more current. So I said, well, yeah, I can appreciate that, but you got to appreciate how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I think you guys could do some of this stuff. So he challenged us with a listing of things that would be Blink 182 type material.
Yeah.
And said, I think you guys could do this. And so actually, 2 years ago, we put in two songs, at which we change now each year to be current with whatever is popular, which means right now we're looking for what are we going to add to the set this year, where we actually do material that is from this day. And the thing that's really fun is, number one, you get all of the kids of the parents who forced the children to come because this is a band from their heyday,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden the kids are coming up to the front of the stage, and endorsing, affirming our taking a shot at the stuff, which is probably way too frantic to do a whole set, but for 2.5-3 minutes we can handle it.
Mm. That's so cool. How many of the guys are you still in touch with from the original band and some of the guys that came in later?
Well, Bruce Maddie joined actually right after I left, and Bruce and I are good buddies. We're probably the cornerstones here for the band as it is. And Rick Barr was the drummer who replaced Billy Herman, actually was the drummer on Roll On, and he's the other cornerstone of the founding days of the band. And Jim Chakowski, still stay in touch by email. Wally Kemp is up in the area. Jerry's up in the area. And, of course, Ronnie I see regularly when either we go to see him play or he comes up and does a tune with us in a venue here or a venue there.
And Jerry and Pat?
Jerry and Pat, I had talked to. I used to live in Florida for about 3 years, and last I knew, Pat was living down in Florida, and we had several conversations when I was down there, but since I moved back up here in 1981, I haven't been in touch with him, so couldn't tell you for sure where he is, but hope he's doing well.
Mm. And Jerry?
Jerry? Yeah, Jerry's up here. He's got a graphic arts studio, so he's still doing creative stuff, as well as, I understand, doing some guitar repair, and his dad and his brother have got a machine shop, so it's all good stuff.
You mentioned your son talking about the band being lame. Mm-hmm. Any of your three children showing the kind of musical talent or creative talent you had?
My son has banged around on the drums for a few years. He even messed around with the guitar for a little bit. But I know that his talents, I think if I had a big contribution I made to the band, it was energy, and it was in perhaps being a wordsmith. And he has done some lyrical things, of course, being influenced by the genre of rap and hip-hop at this point.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff is different, perhaps, than the, again, using the word naive, lyrics that we would have done. But he really has a real skill with words. And both my daughters also have that attribute. And everybody sings, but nobody is, it seems, going to follow after Dad. My brother is probably a more likely candidate to follow after his brother than any of the three kids.
That's interesting. Now, folks out there that want to follow a New Colony 6, there's a great website. It's called newcolony6.com.
Thank you.
And it will have, I'm sure, we're going to actually link it to this interview.
Cool.
So that all of our people can go right to it. And if you want to do the same thing on your website, to link it to this interview as well, so the folks can hear what you had to say, that might be interesting as well.
Yeah. Why don't you, I don't know if you're taping or what.
Well, we are, yeah. This is pmpnetwork.com.
Okay,
PMP. Like Peter Mary Paul Network.com.
There you go.
And we'll be up tonight around 7 o'clock with this interview. So folks will be able to hear it live. And it'll be streaming in real audio.
7 p.m. Where am I, 7 p.m.? I'm standing in
the... You're 6, I think it's 6 o'clock your time.
Okay. Yeah. I'll unfortunately be downtown at a conference. So
well, you can listen to it all night. It'll be playing all night and all
really?
Day for about the next month.
Okay.
Yeah, so you'll be able to hear it anytime you want to. As will any of your fans.
Neat.
Yeah. So it's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we can speak again sometime.
I'm here.
And I look forward to speaking with some of your bandmates in the future sometime.
Yeah, that'll be fun. That'll be fun. It's I would imagine you've made contact with Ronnie, or no?
Actually, I haven't, no.
Certainly you can go to, what does he call his site? Do a Google search under Ronnie Rice, and I'm sure you'll find it.
Yeah.
Because he's got a website, and he'll probably give you a way to get in touch, at least by email.
Well, if you talk to him, you can also send him over.
Yeah, when the summer comes up, I'll let him know.
Okay. Take care of yourself.
I will plan on doing that, and you do the same. Thanks for spending the time and raising a lot of pleasant memories. Makes my afternoon go real easy now.
Well, it was a wonderful time for me. I'm remembering my, as I said the other day, that the daily newspaper here did a story on me, and I said to them that I enjoy reliving my childhood every day, and that's a thrill for me as well.
Uh-huh.
Take care.
Fun stuff.
Nice to meet you, Ray.
Okay, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.